And first thing on the agenda is road user fee pilot program. Who's going to come up and talk to us? Welcome, Jim. Start it out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're pleased to be here again. I have with me today Professors David Porter and David Kim from Oregon State University. I want to give you a brief update as to what's happened with changes in the pilot, and then I'll turn it over to them to answer your questions on the technology, which I understand you have some interest in today. The original pilot area, which was Eugene, as it turns out, is not going to work for us. The reason for that is that we contacted every service station in Eugene, and although we got a couple of interested service stations to get involved, they were branded stations, and so we had to work with the major oil companies on that. We actually made a real strong effort to try to get them to consent to use our port and sale system. He even went down to Chevron's international headquarters outside of Oakland and had a nice meeting with the fellows, but they just weren't quite ready to consent. We also met with the Western States Petroleum Association, who, although quite happy to meet with us and spend time talking about this, still didn't quite want to let their point of sale systems be used. So the only people we had, or the stations we had that were interested in Eugene, were branded. So that took care of that. We then moved to Independence, unbranded stations, and we have identified an owner up in Portland and Gresham area who is interested, and we are entering into contract negotiations right now with that owner, and it looks very positive. So we're shifting to Portland. The other thing that's really changed is that we had some contract issues with the next phase of getting Oregon State going on the technology, and that took a little time. And so that plus the fact that we had to shift caused our pilot timeline to move a bit from November to about March. So of next year, March 2006. So we'll complete that year-long pilot in the middle of the 2007 session. At least we won't begin it during the 2007 session. So that's really it for the pilot. What has changed since we last spoke? But I think that today is the best opportunity for you to ask your questions on the technology and come to as much as a complete understanding as possible.
Thank you.
Questions? I know you do. Yeah. Representative Burley. I'm just going to let you take it for a little bit. I'm going to run out. I'll be right back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last time we had an informational meeting on this, one of the questions that had come up was the question about the flow of information between the on-vehicle device and the GPS satellite. And, you know, it was indicated to us that that was a one-way direction. And, you know, I'm certainly not the technical expert, but I just really kind of have a hard time understanding how that can be the case. So that's one of the things that I was particularly interested in, was trying to help for you to help me understand that, in fact, this is a one-way flow of information. Because, as you know, I mean, some of the folks out there, that their initial reaction is they're not real crazy about this idea, and the privacy issue and Big Brother tracking them all over the state was one of those questions. So that's what I was particularly interested in hearing about.
Okay. Yeah, my name's David Kim. I'm an associate professor at Oregon State University, and Representative Burley. The answer to that, or I guess some more information on that, is if you think of the GPS system, I mean, it's made up of, I think right now there's 24 satellites really circulating out in space, and they're broadcasting information. And that's really all that they're doing. So you can almost think of it as being analogous to like a radio tower that's broadcasting radio signals. So when you listen to the radio, your radio doesn't actually send anything back to that radio tower. In the same way, this on-vehicle device has what's called a GPS receiver in it, and that receiver just has the capability of actually receiving and interpreting that the signal sent out by those GPS satellites, but it has no capability in itself to actually send anything back. And in fact, I don't know this for a fact, but I don't think the GPS satellites have any way of actually receiving anything from, you know, little devices like we're putting on the vehicles.
That's great. That was a simple explanation. Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, I think part of the confusion is that there is a pilot project up in the Puget Sound area where they are transmitting by cellular, and that, I think that needs to be understood. Would you like to go into that? I think that would help.
Right. I mean, Mr. Witte was specifying, as well as I think other things that have been in the press, have kind of created this misconception or this association with GPS and the ability to actually track and watch a person or a vehicle or some entity. And as a matter of fact, actually that capability has to be built into whatever device has a GPS receiver on it. And so the study in Puget Sound that Mr. Witte was referring to, they're actually interested in, a similar concept with, I think, charging people for rates for when they drive on the roads based on congestion. But in that particular study, the devices that they actually have can receive the GPS signal, similar to what we're doing, but not only do they have that capability, they also have cellular communication capability onboard the device that has the ability to send that information the other way. And so that, you know, the location information is being interpreted from the GPS signals that the device is receiving, and then that information is then being sent out of the device, which then gives, in this study, the capability to actually track where a vehicle has been or where it's going, or where it's actually been, or in real time you can actually watch where it's going.
Well, that raises another question, and that is that given the way that this pilot test is being configured, does this allow for the possibility of congestion pricing type programs as well?
Yeah, I mean, it does, but it's not, I mean, I think in contrast to the what I understand about what's going on in Puget Sound, they can actually adjust the pricing based on actual information on the current status of roads in real time. Whereas in this particular study, we were actually going to define different areas. Let's say a rush hour area could be, for example, downtown Portland, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. And then mileage will be accumulated. The miles that a vehicle drives in that zone during those times will be actually collected by the device. And then a higher rate can be charged to those miles. But at no time do we know really what the real traffic conditions are, you know, during those actual rush hour zones or time periods.
Okay, good. Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you haven't been on this week, I would encourage you to go on to blueoregon.com because there's a whole series of people discussing. It's a blog site, and this happens to be one of the major topics for the week. And it's kind of a progressive Democrats site, but it's like a black helicopter landed right in the middle of the site based on the discussion. So you should go on there and provide some facts that you probably are in the best position to articulate. I'm wondering, though, based on all you've heard criticisms, conspiracy theories, concerns, a whole variety of things. Which are the ones that you think, what are the ones that you're hearing the most, and what response can you give us as we're hearing those to respond to those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, you hear really two basic issues with this whole thing. One is the privacy issue, and most of the people that go into that issue don't delve very deeply. They see GPS and they say, I know what that is, and they really don't. The second issue is the tax rate, the fee rate, and that there's a concern that if you would advantage drivers with low fuel efficient vehicles against those with high. The way that I address that latter one is that's not for us to decide, it's for the legislature to decide. So it's a matter of structure. of the rate. You could have a base rate that everybody pays, and then you could have a structure where some vehicles are advantaged and disadvantaged. You could do any number of things. Tax committees know how to do this very well, as I'm sure you're aware. So I've never had a concern about that, because it doesn't have to be flat. This is for the legislature to work through. If they want recommendations about different structures, different possibilities, where we would be pleased to give you different possibilities for that. But it's not essential to the mileage fee that it be flat. So that's the second one. The first one, the privacy issue hasn't been a concern for me personally, because we gave them the directive and to develop a technology that they're not be tracking. We said, we don't want cellular, because that's a broad-based transmission, and it's designed for somebody to pick up. In Puget Sound test, they're sending a monthly bill from another location, so they need to have that transmission. In the Oregon test, we didn't want to do that. Monthly billing's too expensive. Cellular is expensive. There could be potential for tracking involved. This is why we moved towards the service stations. So there's the only thing transmitted is a mileage number by short-range radio frequency, and there's nothing going anywhere else at any time. We did that as a matter of design. And so, as a matter of fact, the devices that I mentioned last time, General Motors is going to put OnStar in their 07 model as standard equipment. And this is the first step that would mean that we may not have to mandate a technology in the vehicles. And I was thinking about this. GM is going to run into this issue with their OnStar device, which is a navigation device that does have cellular transmission capabilities. And I was thinking, how is GM going to deal with that? And then it occurred to me, obviously, the people that buy the vehicles will be able to switch that off. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to sell. But the point is that we don't care whether they switch it off or not. Our system would work on or off, because it doesn't require the cellular transmission. It's not even a part of the system. We've designed away from it. So we've worked very hard to deal with these issues. Because we're Oregonians, and we recognize I was born in the state, and I recognize issues that Oregonians will have. I knew them before we started.
Yes, Representative Boone.
You could add, you probably were born, and your first words out of your dad's mouth to you were, you will be an Oregonian like me.
Yeah, didn't have a choice.
That's right. I'm really impressed with what you guys have done. I really am. I think that's just great.
Thank you. Further questions?
Just one of them. Boy, thanks for coming today. I appreciate your answers.
Mr. Chair, if I may, we are preparing a report. It'll be coming to you shortly, that outlines all the various choices that the legislature may make in pursuing this. Because we have prepared a concept doesn't mean that our concept is your only choice. There are numerous policy issues that the legislature can dig through and make choices this way or that way. They'll have consequences perhaps, but they might be consequences that you would prefer apart from what we are recommending. So that will be coming within a few weeks.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 481.
Sorry, Patrick. I snuck up.
Oh, it's okay.
Little summary there, if you have a chance.
Senate Bill 481A. Deletes the prohibition and statute on the use of roadside rest area structures by organizations that provide refreshments at the rest area, and deletes provisions prohibiting those same organizations from soliciting donations for the refreshments which they provide. There was no fiscal or revenue impact for the bill. It passed the Senate on a 27-1 vote.
Ryan, you're the only one signed up, too. What does that mean?
tremendously important piece of legislation. It has been well worked.
Does that make this a defining moment?
I don't think so. My name is Brian Doherty with the Miller Nash Law Firm, but I'm also chair of the Travel Information Council, and they are an organization that's been set up after billboards were pretty much eliminated in Oregon. We do a lot of signage and do a lot of rest area work. I sent a letter to the committee last week just talking about this particular bill. It's a kind of a, when you just had a bathroom in a rest area, they decided that was a poor place to let these nonprofits be selling coffee. So they said you can't be in a structure in a rest area, and now you see them all out in trailers passing out coffee for free. Well, now we are building new rest area structures, kiosks that have travel information, as well as the Commission for the Blind have vending machines, and we're going to have something here for someone to serve coffee. And again, no state dollars are involved in upgrading these rest areas. But we want to just change this one word, allow them so they can go into the structure, which I have pictures I have shown Chair Gilman, but it's a much nicer looking rest area appearance, and this will allow them to sell their coffee there instead of in a trailer in a parking lot. The other change has to do with removing the word solicitation that came up in the Senate committee as a complete surprise to us who were dealing with a completely different issue. But because of the Supreme Court's decision, we have eliminated the words but may not solicit them at the rest area. And that's completely unrelated to our discussion here today, but it has to do with the Supreme Court ruling that you cannot prevent solicitation on roads in the state. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions. But we think it's a good bill, and it could really change Oregon's rest areas forever.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Will they have cookies?
I'm just reading that. I think it does say cookies offered on the program must come from a licensed facility. So, yes, they'll have cookies.
Question over here.
I think you might have answered it already. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was, what about construction of these, of some sort of a facility? I mean, when I read this, it didn't really say whether or not anybody could construct a facility. But apparently the authority's already there. You've got something worked out with the department already, and you are doing that. So,
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, what we have is ODOT is responsible and approves anything in a rest area. We're working on programs with ODOT on these upgrades. And so that's where the authority would come from. It has to come under their approval, where we can get some federal grant funds from the Federal Highway Administration and some private donations. It'll still be under ODOT's supervision and control.
Brian, before you go, because I've got this constituent, you already know what the question is. He really would like Burger King to be operating these rest areas, or McDonald's or Taco Bell. Talk to me a little bit about the problems, if there are some, or if this is a possibility.
Chair Gilman, there was another companion bill, Senate Bill 483, which had, in our vision, was going to be a limited vending of products in rest areas. And what our idea was is we're going to open some very major travel plazas that will have like a gateway to Eugene or a gateway into the Tri-County area and then bring them out that would have tourism-related information. So it would be to sell you hazelnuts from McMinnville, but to encourage you then to get off the road and go travel into our areas. And so it would be themed to that area. You have very concerned convenience store owners and others that are worried, are you competing for their dollar, for their soda pop, their candy bar, their things, and you're putting it out under a, boy, everybody like to be out there at this point. One of the problems you have in going out into those rest areas is, and I didn't know that until this year, is that the Commission for the Blind has the right to vend, sole right to vend products in rest areas throughout the United States. It's a federal law. And it's in the state as well. So you see the vending machines there. This is somebody did a very good job of lobbying for the Commission for the Blind. They have all the vending rights. We were working with them, and we will still try to work with them to see if we can't come to an arrangement where you'd have some limited vending, and we may come back in the 2007 session. It's fair to say that the powers that be were not too thrilled to on the Senate side to consider a McDonald's in rest areas and state highways and those things. And so there is some feeling that that's not the direction we want to go in Oregon. We were trying to write something that was a more middle road. I tried to amend it to say we've limited sales of only local tourism products in an effort to promote the economies and the tourism in those regions. It needs some work. I think we need to do some more work in the interim. I think once we see these travel plazas, you'll see there will be a nice place to come off. You'll have touch screens with computers. You can tap out if you want to figure out how far to get places. It's going to be a very nice setup, and they're in other states. And hopefully what we want to do is have them relax, slow down, and drive into the local area and enjoy the local tourism and local economy.
Thank you. Any further questions? Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 481?
Guess not.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 481. Representative Burley.
Mr. Chair, I move that we report Senate Bill 481A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Burley moves Senate Bill 41 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mike, I guess it's time.
Representative Burley. Aye.
Representative Hunt. Oh, excused.
Representative
Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Chair Gilman.
Aye. Carries. Consent calendar?
Yep.
Yeah. Representative Burley moves place 481 on the consent calendar. Any discussion? Any objection? Sword. Perfect. Oh, and I forgot to mention when we first started, there's a work session down for 102, but we're not going to have a work session on 102. Okay, we'll open the public hearing on 997. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 997A authorizes vehicle dealers to charge a fee for preparing documents to issue or transfer a certificate or a title of registration. No, it authorizes the department to limit the amount of that same fee. No revenue impact and just a minimal fiscal impact for this measure. It was reported out of the Senate with a 26-0 vote. And in your packets, we have freshly minted, just received about an hour ago, -A4 amendments, and I believe Daryl Fuller is here to speak to those.
Come on up, Daryl, and Daryl
Pellegrini.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller representing the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, which is the association representing franchise new car dealers. Senate Bill 997 is a bill that we requested. The amendments adopted on the Senate side to give you an A in gross bills were amendments that we requested. And now we're before you with the A4 amendments, which we've also requested. And we think we finally perfected the bill. You could maybe subtitle this The Tale of Four Lawyers. Anytime you put two lawyers together, you have a problem. When you put four lawyers together, you get a big problem sometimes, and I say that with all due respect to my colleague up here, because I'm not a lawyer, and I trust them to do good work, and they do, and so it's just a matter of ironing out the details. There has not been an issue on what we've tried to accomplish. There's just been an issue of trying to get the language to do what we're trying to accomplish. Auto dealers, when you buy a car, we process the paperwork for you, the title and registration paperwork, and we collect the DMV fees. We employ at larger dealerships personnel who do nothing but collect taxes and fill out paperwork on behalf of customers, because the paperwork is pretty extensive and it's got to be done correctly or somebody else gets the title to your vehicle and you don't want that to happen. So all the letters and numbers in the VIN number have got to be exactly correct and everything's got to be correctly done or we cause problems. In exchange for doing that paperwork, we have the ability to charge our customers a fee for providing that service. It is an optional fee. We sell a negotiated price item. Everything is negotiable at a car dealership, including the fee that we charge customers for doing this paperwork. The cap that is on there is a $50 cap. We can't charge more than that. It is the language in the bill says that the state cannot adopt a cap that is less than $50, because when we moved the dock fee from administrative rule, which originally had no statutory authority underneath it. It was just a rule that had been adopted. So when we moved it into statute, we didn't want the fee to be reduced because we were moving it into statute. So the agreement we came up to was language that says that the Department of Transportation can adopt rules to increase the fee above $50, but they couldn't create a rule that would decrease it below the price that we had agreed to in terms of what we would charge customers for this fee. So we've had a dock fee of one kind or another, either in statute or in rule, since 1993. It's only been changed once, and that was in 2001 when we moved it from rule to statute, and it was increased from $35 to $50. Again, customers have the right to negotiate that fee, or if they complain about it, I don't know a single car dealer that's going to lose a car deal over $50. They'll simply eliminate the fee if they have to. It's listed separately on the contract, and the customers have an option to look at that and decide if they want to pay that or not. Last session, or two sessions ago, and I apologize for my memory, we started a process where dealers could connect their computers directly to DMV computers, and rather than filling out information on our computer, spitting out paperwork, and taking that paperwork to DMV for them to then rekey the same information into their computers, we eliminated that duplication by allowing the dealer's computers to talk directly to DMV's computers through a third party called an integrator. And that integrator, and this is, again, a product essentially that we can sell to our customers, that integrator charges the dealers a fee for connecting to DMV. So then we were allowed to charge a higher fee if we were doing the electronic transfer. The advantage to the customer is the records get updated quicker, instantaneously, and they can get the license plates and the stickers right there at the dealership as opposed to waiting several days for the dealership to go to DMV, submit the paperwork, wait for the title or the plates to be issued, pick them up, bring them back to the dealership and have the customer come and get them. So we were able to inventory and distribute the license plates and the stickers right there in the dealership. So we offer the customers, those dealers that are signed up to do it electronically, and dealers aren't required to do this. Again, it's a service that they offer their customers. They say for an extra X amount of dollars, we can give you the plates and stickers today and do it electronically, and the customer can choose to do that or not choose to do that. That fee is not regulated by statute. When the statute was written in 1997, it specifically said that the government cannot set what that fee is going to be. It would be a market-based fee. We are in a cooperative agreement with DMV, agreeing to set that fee at not more than $25 over the $50 fee. So the maximum that a customer would pay would be $75 for having it electronically transferred as opposed to by paper form. In exchange for that, part of the negotiation we've had with DMV and with the Department of Justice is the Department of Justice has held that if a customer pays cash for a vehicle, that customer has the right to demand the old title, the existing title to the vehicle, and to go to DMV and process the paperwork on their own instead of letting us do it for them. We believe that there are, we have concerns with handing a title over to a customer who's paid for the vehicle because that title has previous owner's information on it. So we have concerns about privacy issues. And we have concerns about customers who will take that title and then never transfer the vehicle into their name because they're going to use that vehicle for running drugs or doing any number of things. Something happens to the vehicle, DMV checks the records, it goes to the previous owner, and all of a sudden, literally, the cops are knocking on somebody else's door wanting to know why they've been cooking methamphetamines in the back of a car that they sold to us 6 months ago. So to avoid that, it's always been our position that we should be able to tell the customer that we're going to transfer the paperwork for them. We're going to make sure they get the title in their name, but that we're not going to give them the previous title. And the Department of Justice has finally come around to our point of view that they believe that there's enough valid reasons for a dealer to tell a customer that we're not going to hand the title over to you. We're going to do the paperwork on your behalf. You don't have that option. But they do have the option of negotiating the fee that they pay in exchange for us doing that service for them. This bill simply codifies that information in statute, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 2 of 997A, which the Dash A4 amendments doesn't touch, it talks about the study that was required by the 1997 law. And in your written testimony, you talk about the implementation of that being delayed because of the 2000 computer scare and all that kind of stuff. Is that study done? Is it something that we're still waiting for, or have we fully implemented this integrator program? And thus, I'm kind of where I'm headed with this, is can we just strike this whole section of code if it really isn't applicable anymore?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, the report was given to the 99 legislative session. There was a report that was delivered. The statute is fully operational. Certainly, you could remove that section of the statute. I don't think there would be any problem with it other than delaying moving the bill to get another amendment to do it. And I understand that you guys are getting ready to close, so, but I don't think it would have any impact in the law. But I'm not an attorney, so I maybe defer to Ms. Pellegrini.
Phil, do you want to weigh in on that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm the Attorney in Charge of Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection. Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I would be happy to find out from the Department of Motor Vehicles General Counsel the status of that report and the implementation issues. It's not something that we particularly deal with down in financial fraud, but if it's of interest to you, I'd be happy to find out and get back to you.
Well, I'm always interested in getting rid of what's not necessary,
sure.
But at the same time, I don't want to delay this bill moving forward either. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I would commit to you that we'd be happy to look at that issue and bring legislation next session that would eliminate that if there's no reason to have it there. I'm with you. I'd like to see you guys eliminate a few pages instead of expanding the number of pages in the ORSs every session.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yes, Mr. Fuller, we talked a little about this today, but just for the record, I wanted to explain why you would need permission from the state to charge a fee for the documents rather than just charging a fee for the documents yourself.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I guess there are a couple of different answers to that question. Number one, we're acting as an agent of DMV, and so part of that agency agreement includes what we can or can't charge for providing that service. Now, this is not a government fee. We cannot represent the fee we charge as a fee that's required by government or that it's a mandatory fee. It's an optional fee that we have. There are a number of states that have statutes that outright prohibit dealers from charging a fee in exchange for processing the paperwork. In those states that do have where fees are allowed, some statutes cap what that fee is, and some statutes simply indicate that dealers may charge the fee but don't put a cap on it at all. But in all cases, as far as I know, every state has statutory language that indicates whether or not the dealer has a right when acting as an agent for their DMV to process this paperwork, whether or not they can charge a fee for that. The second part of that answer is the Department of Justice regulates through their Consumer Protection Division our advertising rules and disclosures that we're required to have for customers to indicate what they're paying for and what they are buying. And part of those disclosures include any fees that are over and above the cost of the vehicle itself. We advertise what the purchase price of the vehicle is, and we're required to disclose if what the customer is going to pay is anything more than what that amount is in the newspaper or radio or TV ad, we have to disclose what those additional fees are that aren't included in the price of the vehicle. Those fees are currently the cost of the title, the cost of the registration, the cost of a DEQ certification if the vehicle has to be DEQ'd, and the processing fee that we charge. If we didn't list that, then they would say that the fee has to be included in the price of the vehicle.
Further questions? Sort of. Huh?
Sort of, yeah. All I can think of is then it sounds like you do want to provide this service in that you have, like you're talking about the drug dealer scenario where they don't remove the previous owner's name. So why don't you just add it to the price of the car?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, certainly that's a way that can be done. And I think if you look at almost any industry, you find that there are costs over, you know, if you order the example that I use is probably the best example I can think of. If you go to a JCPenney's catalog and you order a comforter out of the catalog, you know that they're going to ship that item from a JCPenney's warehouse on a JCPenney's truck to the JCPenney's store for you to pick it up. And since it's advertised for a price in the JCPenney's catalog, you know you're going to get it shipped, but yet you still pay a shipping and handling charge over and above the price of the item. JCPenney's could add the cost of shipping into every item in their catalog and make it simpler for everybody. When you buy a home, there are costs associated outside of the price of the vehicle or outside of the price of the home for going through the titling process and all of the different inspections, and all that stuff is outside of the price of the purchase of the home. They're outside of actual retail purchases inside a grocery store or even gas stations, and we don't have the price of deposits on cans and bottles listed when you buy a bottle of pop. I mean, there are just certain items that are not listed as part of the core purchase price of a product in most cases.
Okay. Cheryl, did you have anything else to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe four sentences. First, the department has taken a neutral stance on this matter. We did receive information from Oregon State Police indicating that abandoned vehicles on roadways had increased over the last 5 years. They did present a public safety risk, and that many of the vehicles that were abandoned when the state police called a tower and then attempted to discern who the registered owner was, that it was not at all clear, and often the person last listed as the registered owner was not the current possessor of the vehicle. So that was part of the information that persuaded us to rethink our position. And just to maybe put a finer point on the fact that the bill changes current law by now allowing dealers to essentially say, we are going to process the paperwork for you, but it changes nothing else in terms of what price a consumer will ultimately pay. And in that regard, there is no change from current law, and in fact there cannot be, because if we were talking about a circumstance where dealers were suddenly allowed to say, you must pay this charge, then it would become a tax, and it has a significant number of legal implications. And so I just want to be clear about that, that it's not changing anything, as Mr. Fuller had said, from the current status of the law, which is that this is a negotiated price for a service, just like service contracts, where the consumer is free to negotiate the price of that. Thank you.
Questions? I think that does it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl. Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 997? Close the public hearing and open a work session on 997. Zane Burley.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee adopt the -A4 amendments to 997, Senate Bill 997.
Representative Burley moves the A4 amendments to 997. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that we report Senate Bill 997 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Burley moves 997 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Mike?
Aye.
Excuse. Excuse for a very good purpose.
Representative
Thacker? Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Curious, aye.
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And let's see, consent calendar again?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we place this on the consent calendar.
Thank you. Representative Bruin moves and we place 997 on the consent calendar. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. We have completed our work today. Can you believe that?
Yeah, we are good. We're too.
Patrick, do you have anything else?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
We're all perfect.
No, we don't have a meeting Friday.
No meeting Friday.
We obviously don't have a meeting Monday.
No meeting on Monday.
I'm going next Wednesday.
Wednesday we're going to have a meeting. Wednesday we're going to have a meeting, and then the next week it's questionable. We may have some things we have to... Well, I'm pretty sure we're going to have some things to finish up.
Okay.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, I should mention, I think the date we've been given in committee services for scheduled date for closure of House committees is next Friday.
Really?
What's the date?
The 3rd.
June 3rd.
Is that what you'd heard, Mike?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, yeah,
that's when I heard is the 3rd, which is a week from Friday.
I was going to say, not next Friday, a week from this Friday. Yeah, a week from this Friday.
Yeah.
So we'll do Wednesday. Ooh. And we may have a Friday meeting that week.
That's why I was asking.
I warn you.
I'm not sure how much we got on the docket, but
we will try to get it all done on Wednesday. But
okay.
Very good. If there's nothing else, meeting's adjourned.